Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting your community. And I am your host, Andre Hakes. Today, my guest on the show is Tom Von Hemert, who is the coordinator for the Crisis Intervention Team for the Charlottesville Albemarle area. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Talking with you out in the studio a little bit before we came in here to begin this show, and we were having this conversation about what is mental illness. Now, the Crisis Intervention Team, my understanding is what the CIT does is it trains, for example, law enforcement officers how to deal with situations in which mental illness is a significant factor.
Correct.
Talk a little bit about that, and then let's talk a little bit about mental illness and what it is and how it's defined.
Sure. So I coordinate the Crisis Intervention Team program, and part of that program is conducting trainings for law enforcement officers for not just the city and the county, but for all the rural jurisdictions surrounding this area. So I covered 9 jurisdictions. It's the largest CIT program in the state. With that, we do a training that's 40 hours. It's a week-long training.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the whole aspect is about safety for the officer, for the community, and for the person that's in crisis. And during that training, the officers first go through a part of learning what is mental illness and what is not mental illness. And they spend an entire day visiting all the mental health agencies and programs in our community, Region 10, the Wellness Recovery Center, on our own, the peer-run program that's doing tremendous work, the clubhouse that's on Elliott Avenue, Western State, and learning about juvenile programs that help kids that are in trouble and in crisis also. And then they spend the last 3 days doing crisis scenario work. We can talk about crisis. We can PowerPoint people to death. We can do all the academics. But the way we learn is by doing it. And so we have officers and mental health professionals and the community, people with mental illnesses, that are part of our training, and they act out crises that deal with mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then the officers, using their skills, using their knowledge that they've learned through the training, learn how to de-escalate and looking for better outcomes that keeps them safe, keeps the person safe, and keeps our community safe.
Now, when you say better outcomes, better than what? Why are you doing this? Why do we need this training?
Well, CIT, to me, is a very successful program based on a failed mental health system, not just here in our community, not just here in Virginia, but in our nation. And right now, our jails and prisons have become our number one mental health institutions. Over the last 50 years, the mental health institutions, Western State, Central State, Eastern State, all the large mental health institutions and private institutions have been decreasing the number of beds. Just here in our area, we've lost over 235 mental health beds in our area.
Now, I associate that sort of decline in mental health bed space with the Reagan administration. Is there any credence to that? I mean, my recollection about this, or the word on the street that I remember hearing about this, was that during the Reagan period, there was this move to basically kick all the mentally ill people out of the institutions they were in, and they ended up on the street. And then the result, which wasn't the intended result, was that they ended up getting arrested because they had to go somewhere.
Yeah. It goes farther back than that. It really goes back to the Kennedy administration.
Okay.
And during that time, most of these mental health institutions, a lot of them, not all of them, had deplorable conditions, lack of rights, lack of safety issues.
That's why we make horror movies about places like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, but with that, the government did one out of two things right. One,
okay,
they started closing down these institutions, but two, they failed on the second part, which was to put the money in our local communities. So it's not just having mental health beds. That's only a small part of it, but it's also having access to Medications, access to affordable housing, transportation, support services, recovery services, peer support services, family support services.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been the failure of our mental health systems. And so with that, law enforcement, by de facto, when things get, quote unquote, crazy, when things are out of control, when things are dangerous, when things happening, you call 911. And that's when law enforcement comes in. And the concern is that law enforcement has not been given the proper training on awareness of what to look for in a person's behavior or actions dealing with a mental illness. So when an officer goes to a police academy, which is about 22 plus weeks, they only are given about 2 hours on training about mental illness. And that's how to deal with it, what's called an ECO, an emergency custody order, when somebody is suicidal, homicidal, or inability to care for themselves due to their mental illness. But they're not given the training about de-escalation techniques, about the community resources, about access to services, about working with the different mental health systems.
Now, when you talk about de-escalation, I mean, one of the problems that I could a limited number of options and didn't have the training was that there might be violence. You might have a police shooting in a case where you didn't necessarily need one. Is that a problem? My understanding is statistically a significant portion of police shootings involve mentally ill persons.
It does. When we start our trainings, Chief Longo, who just retired, God bless him, talks about that and is very honest about that those figures. But we also, in when you look at those figures, and you can look at those stats or anybody's stats, but you also have to say what was happening at that incident.
Right.
So, and again, I want to be very honest. I'm not a law enforcement officer, and I'm not a mental health professional. But with that, the stats are alarming. And so that's why we have CIT. And our stats that we're showing have been absolutely tremendous over the last 10 years. So the reduction of people that are being incarcerated because they have a mental illness are, have gone way down. And that's had a factor in our jail. The inmate jail population has been decreasing over time. And one of the major factors that the superintendent said was due to CIT. So we're having better recognition of somebody. But again, just because somebody has a mental illness doesn't give somebody a get out of jail free card.
Right.
Safety has to be the factor first. But what we're training the officers is saying, is this a medical issue or a criminal issue? And if it's a medical issue, then let's appropriately deal with it in a healthy, respectful way to get somebody the services that they desperately need.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying. So talk a little bit about what you mean by mental illness. I mean, we began this conversation with kind of, you know, what is mental illness? And I feel like we sort of got sidetracked into other things, but maybe some important background. But tell me a little bit about what that is. How do you define mental illness?
Well, I would just say that it is a disease. And it is. It's a brain disease. It's a disability. And everybody in our families, everybody, probably has somebody that's dealing with some type of mental illness. So one out of four, one out of five people can be diagnosed within any 12-month period of time with a mental illness. So it's the number one disease in the world. It's the number one disability in the world. But with that, it's also our number one ism. It's our number one fear, more than racism, more than sexism, more than xenophobia, fear of foreigners. It's not part of our vocabulary. When we feel uncomfortable with something, when we fear something, we do one of three things. We either fight it, we get angry about it, and we make fun of it, or we run away from it, or we freeze. And that's what's happened with mental illness. It's the 800-pound gorilla in the room. It's the stigma that nobody wants to talk about. It's not part of our dining room conversation. It's not part of our conversation when we go out to dinner or with friends. We don't talk about mental illness. And what we're trying to do is break that cycle, break that stigma, break that glass ceiling and saying, hey, we got to put this out on the table and have that conversation. And what's tremendous about the CIT training is that we have members in our community that are dealing with mental illnesses and are doing a tremendous job with their own recovery and health. And they talk about what works and what doesn't work when they have met with law enforcement officers. They talk about their recovery, their struggles, their pain, their suffering, their hopes, their aspirations. And that's, and it brings it in on a human level. Because when somebody calls 911, nobody's calling 911 to say, hey, it's my birthday. I'm doing great. You know,
well,
hey,
they are.
I'm having
a wonderful
day.
They're in trouble.
They're in trouble. So, yeah. But we all, so 911 officers are dealing with crises every single day. So it's appropriately named that it's called crisis intervention team, that's what officers deal with every day working in our community. And they do a fantastic, phenomenal job. And so, again, what we're trying to do is develop better communication policies. We've trained 100% of all our emergency dispatchers on CIT. So they're asking more appropriate questions. Is that, you know, is this person in crisis on medication? Are they part of, you know, are they dealing with a mental illness? You know, are there guns out there? When the officer arrives, you know, make sure that you keep your hands in front of you for your safety and for their safety. So better communication for the homeowner, for the person in crisis, for the responding officer. And that's a win-win situation for everybody.
Well, that makes sense. When you talk about mental illness, it strikes me that there is a pretty significant range of conditions that might qualify as mental illness. When you say 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 people has someone in their family who's experiencing mental illness in any 12-month period, I'm thinking, well, there aren't that many schizophrenic people running around. So you're also talking about depression,
sure,
anxiety. You're talking about substance abuse issues as well, yes?
Absolutely. So it's a range. And the same thing I would use with another disease, such as, say, maybe even something as critical as cancer. Mm-hmm. Somebody might have a malignant piece of skin where it could be removed within an hour of outpatient surgery. They're in, they're out. Or it might be something terminal where they have brain cancer, or it's in the lymph nodes or something to that effect. The same thing that goes on with cancer is that it's a range. And where, in layman's terms, I would say to take a look at it, if your health is being affected where it deals with your work and your relationships with others and family over at least a minimum of 2 to 3 weeks period of time, then you are looking at probably some type of segue into a mental illness. And we all have bad days. We all have days that we feel down or in the blues. But when it's longer term and it affects our work and affects our behavior and affects our relationships with others and especially our family, then that's something where you, I would suggest, highly suggest, is that's where you need to ask for help. And people are, one, because of the stigma about that, and it's also, the hard part is the resources in our community. So one of the questions that people ask is, like, what's the easiest way to get mental health services, right? And be honest with you, that might be seriously dealing with an ECO where somebody is at that critical level of where they are suicidal, homicidal, or inability to care for self, and they are being, and law enforcement has to respond.
We're basically saying the best way to get seen quickly by mental health experts in this community is to get arrested. Isn't that basically what you're saying? I mean, taken into custody.
Well, the stats prove that. The national percentage, and this is the same thing that's here in our own community, is that 1 out of 4, 1 out of 5 inmates in our jail systems at Albemarle Community, Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail, have a serious mental illness. And when I define serious mental illness, it's that they're receiving psychotropic meds. It's not just saying, hey, I'm having a bad day. I'm glad they're having a bad day because they got caught with a crime and, you know, you're in jail. But with that, what we really need to take a look at is their mental health, and we also need to be aware of their behavior. And is the behavior of a medical issue, or was it more of a criminal issue?
So, okay, what do you mean psychotropic meds? Let's talk about what that means.
So, you know, I'm not the social worker or the clinical psychologist. So, but the psychotropic meds are for people that are dealing with schizophrenia or bipolar or manic depressions on the serious end of the DSM-5 scale. And with that, they are reviewed and seen by the medical staff at the jail.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, so they have professional diagnosis and review and evaluations from medical trained personnel.
When you say psychotropic meds, we're not talking about someone who's got mild depression who maybe takes Prozac. We're talking about someone who's got something much more significant farther along the scale there, are we not?
It can be, but the emphasis here, and we train this over and over again in our training, is we're not asking our officers to diagnose somebody. We're mm-hmm. not asking them to diagnose them. We're not asking them to be social workers. We're not doing hug a thug. This is about safety, and this is about better outcomes. So the issue for our community is, yes, my emphasis is on law enforcement and the relationship with the mental health system and the medical system. But what we really need to grapple with is the issue of our entire community on how we're working with people that are dealing with mental illness. You're talking about not many people have schizophrenia. That's correct. Less than 1% of our population have schizophrenia, and less than half of that have schizophrenia where it is so bad that, you know, they're hearing voices and seeing things and have feeling like spiders are crawling up their skins. But with that, they're not of that level. Most of those people are not getting the medical services and medications and the support. And that's where you're seeing a lot of the homeless that are out on the streets. That's where you're seeing a lot of the people on the downtown mall or on the highways. And you don't know what they're suffering with.
Why don't our medical benefits programs, I mean, we have some social safety net here in this country that's designed to assist. Why aren't those people getting help through, and I'm not sure whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, mm-hmm. I'm not that kind of lawyer, but,
yeah.
But
and
why,
I'm not a lawyer.
Why aren't those people getting treatment?
Well, let's, you know, you bring up the and most important point is about money. So let's, Virginia is probably, I think, 13th or 14th richest state out of the 50 states based on gross national product. And we're probably about the bottom 15th about the total amount of tax dollars that's going towards mental health services. And there's a disconnect. And we need to get more funds, not just for mental health beds, because that's only a small percentage mm-hmm. of it, but more towards access of services. So there is a tremendous need for increasing access to medical services. I mean, people have a hard time. Region 10 is working tremendous. They're incredible. They're professional. But there's also a capacity factor. They're completely underfunded.
Well, it's like the problem public defenders face. I mean, I am that kind of lawyer. I'm a criminal defense attorney. And while I'm not a public defender, I'm aware of what's going on with them. And the you know, we have buku bucks in Virginia, and we pay our PDs. I think we might be the lowest in the nation. We're either, you know, number 50 or number 49 or, you know, right. something like that. So it sounds like a very similar problem. That's just not where the resources are going.
It's not. And until we bring awareness and get this out on the table and have the community respond to our politicians, to our board of supervisors, to our city councils, to our congressmen and senators, to say we need to have equality in services.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is our number one disease. So wouldn't that, you would think that it would be the number one amount of money that is going on. A lot of institutions, including hospitals, is run as a business.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of hospitals lose a lot of money in the emergency rooms and psych services. So you're not
it's the for-profit model.
It's more than that, you know. So, I mean, you have this new cancer building, which mm-hmm. is fantastic. But we should also be looking at investing into services and programming and medications and access to recovery and peer run programs to help support the families and the patients that desperately need to get services.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Straight Talk and Tom Van Hemert. Welcome back to Straight Talk. My guest today is Tom Van Hemert, who's the crisis intervention training person for many jurisdictions, Charlottesville, Albemarle, basically involved in training police officers how to deal with mental illness. When you came into the studio this morning, you brought us a little present. You brought us a CD, and the CD is something I want to play a few seconds of. A lot of it I can't play because the FCC would be really mad at me for some of the language on it. But I want you to explain a little bit about what you brought me and how it came into existence.
In our training that we do for law enforcement officers, and I've done this training also with medical staff, nurses, law students, psych students, and for different community members, is a recording that was put together by Dr. Pat Deegan. And Dr. Pat Deegan is a clinical psychologist in Florida, and she also suffers from auditory schizophrenia. She and a number of her colleagues that also have schizophrenia put together this recording of sounds and voices of what somebody might have with schizophrenia.
How would they know that?
Well, I mean, this is probably as real as you can get because she herself has schizophrenia and she worked together with other members in her community that also suffer from schizophrenia. So with that, I mean, each person is going to be different, but it gives an insight of what somebody's dealing with. So in our training, the participants have a headphone and are listening to this recording. And during this time, they also have to follow different exercises, simple reading exercises, math exercises, repeating or memorizing different tasks or a word find exercise. And then what they find out is that it is incredibly difficult, if not just painful, to try to concentrate, try to listen, try to react appropriately while listening to this recording. So we can talk about it, we can do PowerPoints, but for the, you know, when you walk into somebody's shoes, then you have a greater appreciation and understanding, empathy of the pain and suffering.
Well, let's hear just a few seconds of what you're talking about, of this recording that has put together what that auditory hallucination experience is like. How easy would it be to concentrate on what was going on around you if you were listening to that?
Well, most of us can probably handle that, which you listen to about 20 seconds worth. But the recording lasts for about 45 minutes and incredibly painful. So at the end, most of the officers or the participants have headaches. They are frustrated. They are tired. They have a hard time to answer those questions. And then we ask them about how that situation was, and they are humbled by this exercise of learning, you know, how difficult, how painful, how, you know, disconcerting it is. And some of the folks are starting to listen to the voices. When somebody has a delusion, that becomes part of the reality. And some of the part of the training that we tell officers is, you know, do not argue the delusion. That delusion is real to that person, and don't also feed in to that delusion. It's, you know, the purpose of the law enforcement is to keep somebody safe and get them the help and the services that they need. So we're training officers slow down because it takes more time to process when you have all these different stimuli, these different sounds, these different voices that are going on in your head, and you don't know if that's real or not real.
Right.
And that's scary.
And so it probably takes a significantly more patience to deal with someone, just in terms of the time allowed for response and the clarity required of communication, to deal with someone who's having that kind of experience.
Yes.
And you can't tell. I mean, the law enforcement officer can't necessarily know what that person's experience is. They might be cued in that there's something going on, but they wouldn't necessarily know what the delusion was.
And that's part of the training, to ask and say, you know, I need for you to listen to my voice, you know, as an officer. I'm here to keep you safe, you know, and asking questions, you know, are you seeing something? Are you feeling something? Are you smelling something? Are you hearing voices?
Right.
And then, or what are you hearing? What are you thinking you're saying? And then working with that person to, you know, say, let's keep you safe, and to slow down, because officers, you know, they are going from incident to incident to incident. Mm-hmm. And they're, to be honest with you, they're listening to voices all day from the dispatcher.
Right, sure.
You know, talking into their own ear with things that are going on. And we all have that kind of confusion. I have four kids, so, you know, I get it in the stereo.
Right.
But we can separate from that, where we can go outside, or we tell, you know, people to go outside or things like that. But when it's constant, what I hear, the feedback from the officers is that they've gone through is like, this was 45 minutes of just pain. And so when you say, how would you like it if this was all day, all week, all month, for years, mm-hmm. that is going on? And that gives a better understanding of sort of the pain and suffering, and just more of the respect of what somebody's dealing with that particular disease.
One of the things that I have heard about police training is, and something that I've sort of observed in the videotapes and such that I've seen, is that a significant portion of what officers have been taught in the past is that when they arrive on scene, they must immediately assert control. You must take control of the situation. And the goal of that, of course, is to sort of get everything calmed down, right, so that you can make assessments and what have you. I wonder if that sometimes that requires a certain level of aggression. And I wonder if that sometimes exacerbates a situation with someone who's experiencing mental illness.
I agree. And so with that, when an officer shows up, just, you know, being in uniform, you know, is a sign of authority. And then with that, during the training, they're learning new and appropriate and safe de-escalation skills, what we call verbal de-escalation. But most of it is also just body language. I mean, most of the way we communicate is by our body, not just the words, but by the tone, by the gestures, by our eyesights, by our posture. And we're working with officers, mm-hmm. keeping them safe, and looking at how not to escalate a situation, but to de-escalate the situation, giving more time, listening to the person's concerns and frustrations and pain, and then learning new skills on how to respond to it, and to acknowledge it and to respect it, and also saying, where do we go from here?
It seems to me that that kind of skill, that kind of de-escalation, might be useful in more than just the mental health context.
Absolutely. And it is a tremendous skill. And officers have said works great whether you're dealing with a traffic incident or you're mm-hmm. dealing with a domestic violence situation. They kid about saying it doesn't work on ex-spouses or anything else like that. It's also important to say what CIT is not. Okay. And CIT is not appropriate when it is, say, an active shooter situation, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or when somebody personal safety is in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be useful to use after that situation is under control, that it is safe to work with that. You know, again, providing that safety, providing that respect and dignity. So to move forward, whether it's taking that person into custody or that might be taking that person in to get medically evaluated.
It seems like, you know, in the news in recent years, our country is facing an onslaught of shooting incidents. Some, you know, there's a category of police shootings that are happening, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about mass shootings by individuals who get a high capacity magazine, a weapon, an automatic weapon, and kill a lot of people. And when those people survive long enough to be evaluated, right, if they're not killed, like the Orlando shooter recently was killed, and so we can't interview him later, we can't know, you know, what was going on there, but when they do, there's often a significant mental health issue, something that would involve auditory or visual hallucinations, paranoia, things like that. I wonder if we were able to get better mental health services, if we might be able to stop some of those things, if maybe, you know, the solution to this is not only, you know, dealing with the firearms issue, but dealing with some of the underlying causes of it.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you take a look at what's happened in over the last couple of years. Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Aurora, Columbine. Those were horrible massacres that occurred. And those have hit the, and there's, you know, it's sad. It's, you know, it was an incredible loss of life. But with that, what is not also hits the paper is the number of people with a mental illness that get used and abused and even tortured or murdered that have a mental illness. And that's not in the paper. So approximately, one out of four people with a serious mental illness will be have a crime committed against them, and that's not publicized. You bring back, you know, to the question of access. So there has to be better process of communication and collaboration between the law enforcement system, the medical system, and the mental health systems. You take a look at a situation like Cho from Virginia Tech. So he aged out. You know, he became 18. So legally, he's an adult. And so because of HIPAA and because of everything else, there wasn't the communication that was going on between the different agencies and to get him the appropriate help. So, again, we want to respect the dignity of privacy, but we also want to have that balance of safety and access to services, so it doesn't get to a situation where you're dealing with a mass tragedy that we've talked about.
Well, serious mental health issues, like, for example, a schizophrenia-type situation, it's my understanding that if you catch something like that early in someone's life, you have a better chance of treating it. Not that it won't exist, but that the medications and the things that we have that, you know, allow us to attack the symptoms of this will be more effective. When I was in law school, I had a class on law, psychiatry, and public policy. And we dealt, I remember learning that schizophrenia forms a kind of a, it's like a synapse, you know, when you have a synapse train, a trail in your brain, if the electronic impulses fire down that trail all the time, it becomes reinforced and it becomes, you know, an easier and easier trail for them to fire down next time. And so if you have someone who's been experiencing auditory and visual hallucinations for 20 years, your chances of stopping them are a lot less than if you have someone who's first experiencing them.
Right. And through MRIs over time, you can see how this brain disease progresses. And so if we took, you know, pulled a couple wires out of this radio studio or your computer or your
car. You mean in that room where, like, I know how to use the light switch
exactly.
And that's it? That one?
That one. So if you did something like that, you know, think about how well those things would work. Not very well. The same thing that's happening with the brain and disconnecting. What I learned when I became involved with CIT was about medications. So of all the medications that are out there, there's no medication that cures a mental illness. The medications are there to suppress the symptoms. But with that, a lot of the medications, they're getting better, have real horrible toxic side effects. So from obesity, liver problems, sexual dysfunction, exhaustion, and heart and other problems. The other part is that it takes time for the medications to work. So it takes time to titrate the right medication for that person over time. And then the access to insurances don't last that long. And then And once you are on medications, a lot of people, like most of us, when we take medications and we start feeling better, about it's average that something like 70% of us don't finish the medication. So again, when a lot of people are taking the medications, you know, they start feeling better, they take off of the medication, get off the medications, and then those symptoms start coming back and we don't realize that. So it's sort of like pick a, the lesser of the two evils, you know, dealing with the mental health and the illness, or you're dealing with the medications and the side effects, and then also trying just to get access to those medications and services for the long term.
Right. And we are in this country right now spending a lot of money building prisons and not spending much money treating mental health issues.
Yes.
And this strikes me as a an approach after the horse has left the barn, that perhaps the better thing would be to, if we had a more robust system in place for dealing with these things on the front end, maybe we would prevent some of the crimes and some of the mass shootings, for example, right, from occurring.
And with that, that's exactly what's happening in the state. I do give tremendous compliments to our criminal legal system. There's the Thomas Jefferson Area Community Criminal Justice Board, and they've worked about this issue and working with the jails, so we're not keep on expanding the jails, and we're working with preventing people from coming into the jails, and just as important, when somebody comes out, to access the services that are needed, and so we don't have the people, you know, the recidivist rates aren't increasing, the frequent flyers, the revolving door, and so we got to look at the system as a whole. Having public safety and having access to services, it's a combination of the two that come together. And they've done through our judges, our prosecutors, our police chiefs and sheriffs, working together with our community, have done a tremendous job. I don't think they get the credit that is due to trying to make things safer and better. But you're absolutely right about the access towards funds. It's really chump change that's being provided towards the mental health systems and the medical systems compared to everything else.
Well, the CIT organization, is it a subset of this board, this Criminal Justice Services Board? Talk a little bit about what the larger board, who's on it, and what their mission is as a whole.
Sure. So on our task force, we have police chiefs and sheriffs. We also have directors from the different mental health agencies on our own, Region 10, the different mental health agencies. And it's also important that we also have members from our community, our mental health community. And those members have said to me very forcefully, don't do for us without us, and making sure that we're involved with that process for their own respect and for their own dignity and for their own rights. So part of that training is that we have members from our community to come in to say, this is what it's like to raise a child with a mental illness. This is what it has been like for me over the last 30 years working and dealing and recovering with a mental illness.
And so the police chiefs you said were on there. Are some of the prosecutors on there?
Yes.
That's great, because they're some of the people who are making charging decisions about what's going to happen to these people. I've had cases like that before where one of the things you see is sometimes you'll have a charge like assault on a law enforcement officer, which carries a 6-month mandatory minimum sentence. And it'll be you'll then find as a defense attorney that your client has mental health issues and that contributed to what happened here. And it's the Commonwealth attorneys who have the ability to make a decision and say, OK, well, we're not, you know, we're going to deal with this punitively. This was not a, you know, caused by this mental health issue, and we're going to put this person in jail. Or, okay, you know, clearly this person has a significant mental health history, and it looks like this is what we're dealing with. This is the root cause of what's happened here. Let's get this person services. And I hear that more and more from our prosecutors in this area. I think they're doing a really good job with that.
I agree.
Yeah. So it's great that they're on that board. How about judges? Do you have judges on the board?
We've had, when we first started this process, when we started looking at developing CIT, the real factor that really started this process was from Jim Hingley.
And oh, I love Jim.
Yeah.
Jim's
so
the best.
He is the best. And unfortunately, he's retiring.
I know. We're
so selfish
him.
Of him, you know, to retire.
I know.
Retire.
What do you think of Jim?
I think he's fantastic. And who gave him permission to retire? I don't know. But
I didn't authorize it.
No. But with that, he at the time, Jim was the director, the chair of the Criminal Justice Board. And he and the board's support of judges and Commonwealth's attorneys and law enforcement agencies and mental health agencies said, we have a serious problem, and we want to look at alternatives to incarceration for inmates with mental illness. So we did a year study, or I did the year study, of research of looking at all the different types of programs that are out there. And the biggest bang for our buck for investing in was CIT. So we were the second CIT program in the state to get developed about 10 years ago. New River Valley down in Blacksburg were the first. And since that
time, beat us out.
I know. Sorry. And they've done a tremendous job. But with that, the success of CIT has been fantastic. And the support of some of the legislators is to support CIT. And so now there are over 35 CIT programs in the Commonwealth. And the biggest part is just keeping those programs funded and existing. We got them up and running. Now they need continual funding to stay operational. And over half of those CIT programs, our CIT program through our officers and our mental health workers, have helped to establish those programs. So tremendous success, but we need to keep that growing. But I'll be honest with you, you know, CIT is a tremendous success to a broken, dysfunctional mental health service and system. And that is the part that we need to have better services, more funding for not just mental health beds, which are expensive and a lot cheaper than a jail. I mean, I'm sorry, just the opposite. Jail beds are a lot cheaper than mental health beds. But with that, we also need funding for medical services, as in counseling, peer-run support programs, access to medications, access to counselors, both professional and lay people. And that is, if we can be, as you said, more proactive instead of waiting for the 911 crisis to occur, then we're going to have even better outcomes. So we have to be more proactive within that. And that's, you know, access to services, access to medications is the way to go.
Well, that makes good sense. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Straight Talk. My guest today is Tom Von Hemert, who is the crisis team coordinator for the Thomas Jefferson area. And we are talking about mental health issues and about how law enforcement and how our legal system really deals with mental health issues and ways we might improve that. I want to take you for a second back to, you mentioned the DSM-5 in our conversation earlier. What is the DSM?
That's the, Diagnostic Statistical Manual that is used for clinically, professionally diagnosing somebody.
That's basically what the psychiatrists use to say this is a mental health disorder or not.
Correct.
Right? It's how we categorize. You know, if you meet these 8 criteria, then you won this diagnosis, right?
Right.
And, you know, I remember hearing a lot about the DSM-4. I guess when I was coming up through law school, that's what we had. And, you know, I know every so often they put out a new iteration of this manual. But what that actually does is change what is and isn't considered a mental disease, a mental disorder.
Right.
And at some point in time, I mean, our culture shifts over time with regard to what we count as a mental health issue or not. And I'm gay. I think I was a mental health disorder at some point in the DSM's history. I'm not sure whether that was 3 or 4. It might have been at 3. I might have had homosexual disorder, right? By 4, I might have had, you know, something slightly more attenuated, and by 5, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's kind of fascinating that we do that as a culture. That and I in our legal system, we have, you know, there's an insanity defense that you can bring, right? If you have a, if you have someone who has committed a crime and they're charged with a crime, you can bring the insanity defense, right? But the insanity defense is so difficult to establish. I mean, somebody, we use something called the McNaughton test, which basically, almost nothing qualifies under the McNaughton test for, and this is to get a not guilty by reason of insanity verdict. But if you did get a not guilty by reason of insanity verdict, you just get warehoused in a mental health facility. So it makes the decision making very complicated with regard to what you want to assert is or isn't a mental illness. That's a shifting sand in the legal system. And then if you do assert it, you might do better to be convicted of a crime in terms of your personal liberty than you would to be to have that successful defense. And it's something I see defense attorneys thinking about. I mean, on listservs and things like the VACDL listserv, every so often somebody will talk about, you know, they've got somebody who's committed an offense and they have mental health issues and they think that they'd be able to make out this defense, or they might be able to make out that the person's not competent to stand trial or what have you. But if it's a small enough consequence in the criminal case, you don't want to do that to your client because your client's going to end up in a mental health facility lockdown. Interesting. You have any thoughts on the intersections there?
So CIT is an exemplary pre-booking jail diversion program. And what I mean by that is that it's the front-end approach. It's trying to keep people out of the criminal justice system, out of the jail system. But there are people that, whether they have a mental illness or not, that commit a crime, a heinous crime, and they will be going through the criminal justice system and to be held accountable for their behavior. One of the things that our community is looking at developing is a mental health docket, working with people.
I've heard about this.
So they're in that process of looking at the numbers and the stats and then saying, you know, what works and what doesn't work with developing a mental health docket. And again, we got to look at the system of not just cycling somebody in, because if somebody is at the jail and they're not getting services, you're right, they're going to be warehoused. And at some point, whether it is a couple of days or a couple of weeks or it might be a couple of years, that person is coming out. And if we haven't dealt with the addiction, if we haven't dealt with the mental illness, if we haven't dealt with the criminal genetic behaviors, then we haven't changed anything, and we're setting that person up for failure coming back out into our communities in our society. So if we want to increase our safety, if we want to increase the health of our community, we need to look at what's happening, not just with the actions, but also with that person's health and behavior and thinking. So when they come out, they get the proper services and everything else.
I spent a period of my career as a special justice for the Fluvanna County Women's Correctional Center. Now, that didn't mean I was there regularly. What it meant was I went and practiced law, and periodically, when they would have a need for a mental health hearing, they would call, and there was another local attorney to Palmyra who would go regularly, and if he couldn't go, I would come from Charlottesville, and I would hear these cases. And what it basically amounted to was shifting an inmate from the regular prison population from the left-hand side over to the right-hand side. And you know, they were still in a cell, but, you know, we moved them over there based on certain criteria. But some of the hearings I remember, I remember there was this sort of hot potato game going on with some of the local community services. We'd have somebody who was getting ready to be released from the prison, right? They had served their prison term. Whether they served it on the left hand or the right hand side, you know, whatever. But they had done it. Their time was up. It was time to let them go. And the women's prison, the administration there would be frantically trying to get some kind of support in place for this person. And, you know, my impression at the time was that some of the providers out there who were supposed to be providing that support were trying very hard not to. They were trying very hard to find that this person did not qualify for their services. And, you know, while I don't remember ever seeing this with a case that I handled, I've heard stories about, you know, well, we'll just drop them off at the bus station. Oh, my God. You know,
and that has happened. You know, where
what is the story with that? Why are the service? Why would the service providers not want to provide the services for the person? Is it a resource problem? I mean, it struck me that it was probably this is going to cost us money and we don't have enough money to deal with this right now. We're full up.
Well, I think it's a capacity issue. I think so many of our programs that are out there are running at full capacity. You look at the emergency room, they're at full capacity. I mean, they have marked tape in the hallways to say that this is a patient's room because they're at full capacity.
You mean so they can call it a room in some regulation somewhere that they put them in this corner or that hallway?
Absolutely.
Oh.
So, you know, that's...
I didn't know that. I never heard that.
Absolutely.
Oh, God.
So that's why they are in desperate need to expand the hospital, which is fantastic. And I give credit to UVA and to the hospital because in the new ED, they're going to have a psych facility in the ED, which will have, you know, 6 to 8+ rooms just for psychological crisis behaviors. And so, again, to provide safety, provide dignity and services, which is the key part, is absolutely critical. So I can't wait for that to occur. So we're moving in the right direction, but you're absolutely right. There are people that are coming out of especially our state prison systems. And the question that you would ask is, you know, for an individual in our community saying, you know, this person's in our community. You know, do you want them next door? You know, you got that whole NIMBYism factor. But you also, if that person's not getting the services that are dealing with their health or their behaviors or their actions, it's a setup for failure. And unfortunately, lack of funding, lack of capacity, lack of coordination. And we also have to say what's working and what's not working with helping somebody else, whether it's mental health or criminal. We have to be honest with that, too.
Well, as usual, it seems like this area is doing a fine job of trying to address these issues. You gave us a metric at some point of how many CITs there were statewide, and I can't remember what you said.
35.
That's pretty good. How many jurisdictions in the state are not served by a CIT? And by jurisdictions, I mean city or county.
Yeah,
county
the jurisdictions of this, city of that. Yeah, the jurisdictions that are not being covered are primarily located in the very rural areas, especially the Southwest Virginia rural areas. You have to remember that there's coverage for the rural areas. You might only have one or two deputies that cover during the evening or the midnight shift. And what we've noted is that a lot of the emergency medical issues with mental health, like the ECOs I mentioned to you, usually happen not between 9 and 5, Monday through Friday, but are happening during the evening time.
Why does that happen?
Good question.
It's like, does it go up when you have a full moon, too? I've heard people say that. I'm not sure if they're kidding or not.
I don't know if there's a correlation. I used to work as a medic, and we were always concerned about the full moon. But with that, it's a safety factor. So when an officer brings somebody in, then they have to usually have another officer to also be with that patient too. And so then there's a safety factor that the community is not having those law enforcement officers out there. And then they are stuck at the hospital if they try to do the right thing to get that person medically evaluated. That's why the jails, be honest with you, were the dumping grounds, because you could take somebody to see the magistrate, be in and out in 20
minutes. They're gone. You're back on the road to deal with the car accident or the bar fight or the domestic.
And if they did the right thing and would have to, what they would say, babysit somebody at the ER, they would be stuck for 6 to 8+ hours. And then if that person was committed, what you call a TDO, a temporary detaining order, and they were committed to a hospital bed, then they had to transport that person, which could take another, you know, 6 to 8+ hours.
Right. And if you've only got two deputies in rural county,
it's a setup for failure on a catastrophic level. So again, we need to look at, so what we've done is we've developed a crisis assessment center in the ED.
Mm-hmm.
So when an officer brings somebody
in the ED, emergency department,
right, mm-hmm. thank you. And they're allowed to do a custody exchange with a UVA police officer or security officer, and then that officer is allowed to go back to their jurisdiction. Quicker,
oh, that's a much
safer,
better model. That makes
more
sense.
Respect, more dignity. So it's a win-win situation. So again,
and it makes it more likely the police officers are going to take them there to begin with because they're not going to be stuck there all night.
Right. So in a nutshell, whether it's in Charlottesville or Albemarle or Kalamazoo, a law enforcement officer only has four options to deal with a mental health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You can resolve on location. They can voluntarily transport somebody somewhere. They can do an ECO, mm-hmm. involuntary transport.
Right.
Or they can arrest the person.
Right.
So before CIT, the easy out was
arrest them
because they weren't given the skills and knowledge of what to do in de-escalating a situation. So now we have the CIT training. So they have learned those skills.
Can the law enforcement officer initiate the ECO? Can
yes.
the law enforcement officer take the person into custody, not as an arrest, but as an initiation of ECO process?
Yes, it can be initiated one of two ways. You can either have an ECO initiated by the magistrate,
uh-huh.
or what the officers would call a paperless
uh-huh.
ECO. That
uh-huh.
means that the behavior that they are seeing and hearing
uh-huh.
States that this person meets that criteria
uh-huh.
for that person to be taken into custody to be medically evaluated.
Sort of like a warrantless arrest.
Right.
Yeah.
But it has to be documented, you know.
Right. Then you document it later.
Absolutely.
You know. Yeah. I understand. Wow.
So we're, you know, what we're seeing is based on our stats from the 911 center is that the officers are mostly resolving most of these mental health crisis cases, what they would call a 931 case, as resolving on location or voluntarily transporting.
Mm-hmm.
And our arrest rates have gone way down
mm-hmm,
over
mm-hmm.
the last 7 to 8 years. So, again, quicker, safer, more respect, more dignity for all. And that's fantastic. So, you know, tremendous respect to the law enforcement agencies, to the leadership of the chiefs, to the medical community, and also for the involvement of our mental health community to be part of this. So it's CIT is not just training. Now, Major Sam Cochran, the founder of CIT, says mm-hmm. that over and over again. It really is a community program, not just a training.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much for coming in to talk with us
about
this today. And I want to thank you for your service. I mean, what a good thing you're doing for the community that you are heading up this effort. I think that there are a lot of people benefiting from what you do that don't know your name.
Well, thank you. I'm the lucky one because I get to work with all these amazing people.
Well, thank you so much. This is Andre Hakes signing off for Straight Talk. Tune in next week.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.